Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. It is Wednesday, June 19th. This is The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. A surge in COVID cases is prompting some hospitals to reinstate mandatory masking in some areas. We get the latest numbers. We also get an update on a lawsuit filed by Hawaii against the oil and gas industry over climate change. And Make Music Day is just around the corner. We revisit a conversation with the familiar Hawaii musician about why creating opportunities for local musicians to perform is so important. Plus, we brought you a local mother-daughter story for Mother's Day. And to be fair, as we come off Father's Day, we bring you a local father-son story that we think you will enjoy. The conversation starts right after the latest headlines. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The latest COVID case count today shows statewide positivity rate is still very high. It is tracking at 16.7%. Kauai County is highest at 28%. Here on Oahu, it is hovering around 20% following FESPAC. The city surge is prompting some hospitals to return to mandatory masking in some areas. Kaiser Permanente says starting Monday, it is instituting mandatory masking at its facilities for staff and healthcare workers because of the increased case count. Hawaii Pacific Health says while masks are recommended at Straub and Palimomi, it has taken a different approach at Kapiolani Medical Center for women and children because of rising numbers. We talked to Scott Miskovich this morning. He had been hired to conduct testing at FESPAC 2024 as a precaution, in deference to the thousands of guests that were here from close to two dozen Pacific nations. FESPAC organizers told us that they had not been requested to provide additional lodging by any of the delegations because of illness. Last week, State Health Director Dr. Kenny Fink had advised them to plan for that possibility. Here's Dr. Miskovich on learning that Kaiser and Kapiolani are taking extra precautions.
I'm very, very pleased that the hospitals are mandating masks, and I think we should begin to do this all over the state. Hospitals are places that people are clearly immunosuppressed and they're ill, and the age group of individuals in the hospitals are higher, and the people that could be coming in, whether emergency room or ICU, et cetera, including staff, can be sick. So we should definitely be doing it, and everywhere should be doing it. I instituted my offices just over a month ago when the numbers started to climb. So I support that completely.
You know, as far as the testing at FESPAC, you know, I know we were concerned for our guests, but the positivity rates were still lower than in the community.
Yeah, I think I'm able to discuss those. Generally, I think it was a tremendously successful event that was held to try to keep the FESPAC members safe and our communities safe. And the positivity rate was definitely below the state positivity rate. We had, a total of 59 total positive individuals the entire time. And interesting, we had at the Department of Health's request, we kept it open to all of the people that wanted it. So there were Hawaii residents that were coming in at the same time. Quite a few of those individuals that were positive were our own local residents. So the number of individuals that were truly ill, there were none that went to hospitals, none that required medical care. I was the one interviewing these individuals that were older, had health risks, and prescribed Paxlovid. And it was small. I think the event was tremendous, and I really give Department of Health amazing credit for their work. And statistically, we had about 13% positivity, to give you an idea, of the 450 people that we tested. And again, some of those were Hawaii residents.
And the cases that required Paxlovid, what, less than double digits?
Oh, yeah, less than double digits. I spoke to all of them directly because you needed a medical provider to review what other meds they were on to make sure it was safe for them to take and to review that they were a Paxlovid eligible individual. That was something I did, and it was a very small number, yes.
I guess we can breathe a sigh of relief, but I know that there's just concern that if people do get sick, we don't know, you know, what the vaccination rates are in some of those places, and you just don't want to spread it.
Kenny orchestrated this, and you know, Governor Green was behind all of this, and the whole concept was to try to keep these people healthy. So what happened is Department of Health had in their storage extra COVID tests, 5,000 COVID tests that had two tests per box, you know, the things that we got from the federal government, were brought to the event, and members of the Department of Health, with really strong handouts, and they try to be sensitive to language and dealt with leadership, distributed these along with another 5,000 masks to all the members of Best Pack that requested them, with the whole concept that protect your island, protect your kapuna. When you go back, if you have symptoms, take your test with you, test. And we explained the differences that could happen where you have to continue to test if you have symptoms, because it can take a couple of tests before you turn positive with those over-the-counter home tests. But, I mean, Department of Health, they had a leader on site, and his name was Kevin Clark, who's a physician and epidemiologist who worked at CDC, who works now at our Department of Health, and he was our main liaison. And I want to give him a personal shout-out because he did a terrific job leading their team.
Well, we see these numbers, and we know when we talk to the Healthcare Association, you know, the positive news was that the numbers are down for the serious cases in the ICU, at least they were a week ago. But, you know, the concern, obviously, with the additional masking that is being mandated now is really to protect both the patients and the healthcare workers.
Absolutely. You know, we're in a very interesting period, Catherine, and that is we have the new, what everyone now knows as the flirt variants that are out there. Now, these are way less sensitive to the vaccination that we all have received if you received it in the past year. And then the other combination that makes it a little dangerous time right now is the older we get, the quicker the vaccine wears off. So that's why the vaccination is recommended every 6 months if you're over the age of 60. Well, fortunately, at the beginning of last week, the FDA overrode a CDC committee and recommended that we take the new flirt variant findings, and that is what is going to be put in the new vaccination that we're anticipating. Likely the first week in September will be available. So I'm getting a lot of questions in my office from this group or at-risk group, what should I do? And I'm kind of at the borderline where I'm telling them probably wait, because you really want to get this new vaccination because it's going to be upgraded to address the new ongoing variants that are a little more serious than the old Omicron variants.
And is there anything else you want to underscore just with these latest COVID counts? Because there are probably a lot more positives out there that the state doesn't know about.
Boy, you just nailed what I was going to say, because I'm actively working, plus we have an urgent care, and plus I have an expert team of people I talk with. I talk with Tim Brown and DeWolf Miller and Jonathan Dworkin and David DeRoff. We communicate 2 to 3 times a week and have throughout the pandemic. And we have concurred that we're at least 10 times higher in the community. So if you look at the 2,000 positives, that means there's 20,000 positives. So, and we also see that people don't test. There's no more free tests. They get a cold, the kids are out having summer fun, and they're coughing and sniffling, and parents aren't testing. Now, the kapuna are testing. That is what we need to have, but the numbers are way higher. And the key is, if you're at risk, wear a mask in public, use ventilation properly to protect, and get evaluated, because Paxlovid is crystal clear. It really makes a difference between hospitalization and death. So the numbers are here. They're going to go down in the fall, and then they'll go back up over Christmas in January. And I think it's clear this disease is here to stay.
That was Dr. Scott Miskovich talking about the official COVID positivity rates, which are double digits, but which he believes in reality are at least 10% higher because people are not reporting cases to the health department or are not testing at all. We have lots of legal developments around the climate front. The governor's office has scheduled a news conference tomorrow to talk about a lawsuit filed against the state by a Hawaii youth a few years ago. But today we have news of another development in a legal challenge filed by Hawaii against the gas and oil industry. HBR reporter Savannah Heron-Pope joins us now. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what is the latest?
Yeah, so this actually goes back to the case we were discussing last week, which is Honolulu City and County's case against large oil companies like Chevron, BP, Sunoco, alleging that these oil companies knew that the use of fossil fuels contributed to climate change and misled Hawaii consumers about those harms. So what we're talking about this week is a related issue that went before the Hawaii Supreme Court yesterday, and that's whether or not insurance companies who have liability policies that they've taken out with these oil companies should be on the hook to pay for oil companies' legal fees in these cases.
So why wouldn't they?
Well, the insurance companies are saying the same thing that the Honolulu City and County are saying, that the oil companies had knowledge that their actions would result in harm. And when you think of how insurance works, right, if you have an understanding that the action that you're taking is going to result in harm, you can't, that's a violation of a liability policy, right? You can't buy a house with a plan to burn it down and then file an insurance claim. But the oil companies are saying, hey, like no verdict has been reached yet in these climate cases. And so if there's even a shred of a chance that we could have coverage, our liability policies say that you have to pay for our legal fees. That's the duty to defend. And their counsel is trying to present the action that they've taken not as an intent to harm, but as possibly reckless or negligent. So in the oral arguments yesterday, when the counsel for Aloha Petroleum, who is named in this case, was asked to define reckless behavior versus intent to harm, he said, well, you know, sometimes you get in your car, you're driving too quickly, you know that that behavior could theoretically result in a bad thing happening, but you didn't get in your car with the intention for a bad thing to happen. Mm. So that's what's being decided by the Hawaii Supreme Court in this case, because the Aloha Petroleum specifically has countersued its provider, National Union Fire Assurance, for breach of contract when they said that they're not going to pay for Aloha Petroleum's legal fees. And there's quite a bit of money on this line. When Aloha Petroleum filed this case in 2022, they said that they had already incurred almost $900,000, and that was 2 years ago. So those costs are racking up. This case is making its way through the courts, and a district court judge has asked for the opinion of the Supreme Court, and that's where we stand. And I spoke with John Ellison. He's a senior partner at Reed Smith about this topic.
This is major high-stakes litigation, and as a result, the insurance issues are going to become major high-stakes litigation, because if the oil and gas companies have to pay for these claims, they're going to need every penny and resource they have available to it, which includes the insurance they bought.
Yeah, big bucks.
Yeah, and John Ellison actually filed an amicus brief in favor of Aloha Petroleum in this case. Here's why.
Historically, these types of product liability claims are what businesses buy liability insurance to pay for. Whether the plaintiffs are right or wrong, people who manufacture things get sued all the time. And one of the things they do to protect their balance sheet and protect their shareholders is buy insurance to defend against the claims that's, you know, you can debate the merits of this because our system is a lot different than a lot of other countries around the world. But in the United States, if you're a product manufacturer, part of your business is dealing with lawsuits because you're going to get sued. It just happens. And so that's essentially the response of, and the position that we're supporting for Aloha Petroleum is that based on the way these allegations are made in these various climate change cases, at present, they're entitled to a defense.
And you were monitoring that hearing yesterday. You know, how did that all go?
So there's still a lot of back and forth between the counsel for both sides and the Supreme Court justices about where the Supreme Court justices are going to draw the line between negligence and recklessness and an intent to harm. And there's a second question that they're also looking at, which is whether or not greenhouse gases are a pollutant. And a lot of liability policies have an exceptions for pollutants. They don't cover them. And so there's this kind of historical understanding of, all right, when did we know that fossil fuels pumped into the atmosphere did enough damage to change our climate? And when did these liability policies, when were these liability policies taken out, and what understanding did we have of greenhouse gases at that time? So the Supreme Court justices are also looking at that question. But if this first question about negligence versus intent to harm gets decided in favor of the insurance providers, that second question is going to become a little bit irrelevant.
Well, yeah, it's a really complicated issue. But yeah, it's just, big money on the table here.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the points that the Council for Aloha Petroleum brought up is that if the National Union Fire Insurance is allowed to deny coverage to Aloha Petroleum in this instance, it's going to get a lot harder for all kinds of Hawaii policyholders to file liability claims with their providers, because now the National Union Fire Insurance has this kind of legal out that's been created by the precedent of this case, where the if they can say that you knew that you were going to, that there was going to be some harm by your actions, they aren't required to pay for your legal fees.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. You don't want to see the ramifications of this. It could be far-reaching. But thank you so much, Savannah. And then I guess we'll see what happens at this news conference tomorrow on the youth lawsuit against the state.
For sure. Thank you, Catherine.
All right. Thanks so much. We have been talking with HVR Savannah Harriman-Pote about the ongoing climate change lawsuit against large oil companies. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. June 21st is Make Music Day. It's an opportunity for folks across the world to celebrate and experience the joy of playing music. It started in 1982 in France and it was imagined as a new kind of music festival, a day where anyone and everyone would be invited to join. Or as Nalani Jenkins says, all kind people, all kind places, all kind music, all on one day. Jenkins is the president of Make Music Day Hawaii. You may know her as one of the members of the beloved Hawaiian music group Naleo Pili Mehana. We had the group in recently as they celebrated their 40th anniversary this year. The Conversation's Russell Subiano sat down with Jenkins last June to talk about making music in Hawaii.
Music is such a big part of Hawaii and Hawaiian culture, but it seems like opportunities to play music have been impacted recently by the pandemic. What do you feel the local landscape looks like for musicians today?
Yeah, you're right. It's changed. I think it was changing even before COVID, you know. Mm-hmm. But live music was something that, like, in the 40s and 50s, Hawaii was just hitting the map of, after the war, and people were like, oh, yeah, you go to Waikiki and there's music everywhere. And it was live music, right? As technology changed, it became less and less live music. And, you know, there was canned music, there were DJs, there were other things. And then you hit a bump in the road like the pandemic, where everybody's isolated and tourism is, you know, very reduced. And musicians in Hawaii found themselves kind of out of luck. You know, the whole digital movement in music has changed too. And so people like us, for Naleo, you could make CDs and you could make a living off of that. Now it's all about live gigs. That's like 95% of the way a musician supports themselves and their families. And that was basically taken away, you know, almost a blink of an eye.
And I know the industry has changed as well, too. I think Snoop Dogg, of all people, just had a rant that I saw on the internet about streaming and who is making all the money off of streaming.
Mm-hmm.
Is streaming and the internet, has that had one of the biggest impacts on the music industry?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember it vividly because our very first music we recorded was all analog. There was no iTunes. And so it was all about if you made records, you sold them, that typical brick and mortar kind of stuff. Once digital came in, it changed everything. And it made some music more accessible worldwide. And that was sort of the feeling. It's like, oh, great, Hawaiian music can be everywhere and people can just buy it online. What it really did is it changed it from a CD or album market to a singles market. And so if you like a music, you like the group, you go buy the single. It shut music stores down, right? Yeah. We don't have any Borders record stores or Tower Records anymore. Shut all the brick and mortar retailers down and sort of left the artist kind of scratching their head, like trying to figure it out.
In terms of financials, are local musicians seeing less coming in from their songs and albums and now more coming from live gigs? Is that how the industry has shifted as well?
Yeah, for sure. Now, not every musician is a recording artist, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of musicians that may not ever have had that revenue stream to rely on, right? For Naleo, that's what we did. We recorded albums our whole career and tried to make as much music as we could. So there's still that group of individual or groups of musicians that just rely on live gigs. And I just want to say this. Some fantastic musicians who have never become recording artists. So to me, it's not because one is better than the other. It's just sort of the journey that you take as a musician. And for a lot of them, the live performing, that's their bread and butter. That's just what they do. It's what they love.
When Naleo first started, I know you guys won Brown Bags like in 84. Yeah,
84. Yeah.
Local Boys, right? iconic song. Were there more opportunities for musicians back then to do coffee houses or restaurants or down in Waikiki? Was there more of those types of opportunities then?
Absolutely, I think so. There were more opportunities for live music. There were more opportunities for recorded music, whether you were able to sign with a big label or whether you just wanted to be like your own record label. At the time in the 80s and 90s, like local musicians were just figuring out how to be an independent artist.
Yeah.
And that, I think, exploded the music scene here. And what I like to share with people, because most people, if you're not in the industry, you don't think about it, but if you're just a consumer of music, what that did was it made it possible for lots of bands to make lots of music, you know? And the consumer is the one that wins, because people who love music, when you think about it, the bands that came out of Hawaii in the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, there were hundreds and hundreds of albums recorded and released every year. And Hawaii had, we had our place on the map, you know? You know, we were known as a regional hub, just like grunge in Seattle and country in Nashville and Broadway in New York. Hawaii had our own thing going, and it was a beautiful time.
And when you look at the musicians that are coming out of Hawaii today, how do you feel about opportunities for them? I mean, when we look especially at like Iam Tongi being this huge winner on American Idol, the like national stages and worldwide opportunities, do those give you some hope that more Hawaiian musicians will be able to participate and have careers in the industry?
Yeah, but you know, careers can vary, right? Mm. So look at like Bruno Mars, right? Local guy. He pretty much performed as like a street performer and then with his family and shows, he had to go and sign a major deal, right? To become like a full-time, that's his life, and to be really like successful at it. I would love to see that happen for Iam Tongi too, right? But how many of our artists can really take that next step and bridge that and do it nationally or internationally? The way I see it, the ones that can, awesome, go for it. They represent Hawaii, but not many can. And the ones that want to still be a viable musician and do it as their career have to figure out how to do it without those opportunities.
Yeah.
And that's really my passion. We had Brown Bags. That helped to launch us. That helped to put us on a certain stage that we could then utilize and grow our career. But today, it's not like a one way to do it. You know, musicians are very resilient, very smart, and they figure out how to do it. They're scrappy.
One thing that Robert Kikaula told me years ago was that he felt that local artists had to go outside of Hawaii if they wanted to get onto a national stage or be able to put their music out to a wide audience. Do you still feel like it's necessary? Do you think that's kind of what the industry is telling them, that they have to leave?
I think right now that's where the biggest opportunity is. But, you know, for the three of us, we were mothers, and we didn't want to tour all over the world for our whole life. And so there are ways to construct a nice career and still stay home. I think it just depends on what your objective is and how big you want to be. But, you know, if you want to be at that level, at the Bruno Mars level, the Iam Tongi level, you probably have to go out and sign with a major.
Yeah. I do want to get to Make Music Day because it's opportunity, right? It's more opportunity for more music, for more musicians to get their name out there and to have this experience. So June 21st is Make Music Day, and you're part of an event here in Hawaii that is encouraging every kind of musician, young and old, amateur and professional of every musical persuasion, to share their music. Can you talk more about the event?
It's my passion project. Make Music Day is celebrated in over 1,000 cities and 120 countries around the world and has been for over 40 years. It started in France. I found out about it during COVID, and I said, just this conversation we're having, wow, what a great way to support Hawaii's musicians and to have more live music playing. And it's, you know, all kind people, all kind music, all kind places. And for me as a musician, that's like, oh, that's my perfect day, right? Imagine strolling around, somebody's playing on a sidewalk, somebody's in a cafe, you're on the beach, somebody's jamming under a tree, big concert at night at, you know, our beautiful venue. So the idea for Make Music came to me. I applied to be a part of the National Alliance. So there's over 120 cities in the United States that have chapters, and now Hawaii has a chapter. And it's just a way to elevate the musicians, give them a chance to perform. All the events are free, by the way. So the idea is that if we can connect venues who support music with artists who want to make music, maybe on that day the artist is playing for free. But what we found is that they make connections. And the venues go, hey, you're pretty good. Maybe we should have more live music here. And they've come back and told us that they've had opportunities to gig more. They've made connections with other artists. And even some of our local artists here have been able to participate in some of the national programs with Make Music Day, to where composers get matched with other composers, producers get matched with other producers. I mean, it's amazing, all the opportunities. And I think Hawaii is just representing us and our people in an amazing way.
It's pretty cool to think about one day where people all across the world are making music. Is that kind of how it'll be? Just continuous music making from the start of the day, you know, across the world and wrapping up with us here on this side of the timeline?
Yeah. We have events scheduled right now, and it's going to carry on throughout the day with different events, some of them big, some of them small. It's going to be music everywhere. Hawaii is definitely joining the global celebration. So I really want to encourage all of your listeners to go to our website, makemusichawaii.org, check it out. Everybody is welcome. I'd love them to join us. If not, check out our map. All the events, like I said, are free, and your listeners can go and find a place to enjoy music. And in that way, they are supporting the music makers because they have an audience to play to.
Lalani Jenkins, thank you so much for coming into the station today. Really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you so much.
That was noted local musician Lalani Jenkins talking with HPR's Russell Subiono last year about Make Music Day. This year, the statewide festival will take place on Friday, June 21st. And here on Oahu, Alliance Francaise of Hawaii has an event at the Fusion Wine Bar that evening, since this event was created in France. Look for links on the conversation page of our website later today.
Blinded, don't thrill me, 'cause I'm in love with the local boys. Don't try to convince me, because the local boys are local, oi. It doesn't matter what island, in the mountains or near the sea, if I want someone special, local boys.
Today's Mono Minute spotlights a bird just over 5 inches in length, beak to tail, small enough to sit comfortably in the palm of your hand. But don't underestimate this little bird. Its song packs a punch. For this week's Mono Minute, University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the red-billed Leothrix.
Red-billed Leothrix are one of the prettiest non-native birds that live in Hawaii. While their body feathers are mostly grayish-green, both males and females have a golden-yellow throat, red, orange, and yellow stripes on their wings, and, as their name implies, bright red bills. Leothrix are native to Southeast Asia and southern China and were introduced first to the island of Kauai as cage birds in the early 1900s. By the 1920s, they were one of the most common birds in the lowland forests of Kauai and on most of the other main Hawaiian islands a few decades after that. Strangely, they seem to have gone extinct on Kauai, even though they're still common on most of the other islands and are resistant to mosquito-transmitted diseases like avian malaria that are causing sharp declines in our native bird species. Even though Leothrix spend most of their time foraging within just a few meters of the forest floor, they can be very hard to find because they're usually in dense shrubs and small trees. Because of this, they're more often heard than seen. They have three main kinds of vocalizations. The first has a variety of notes and is sung by males during breeding season to attract females. A second song is much simpler and is sung by both sexes throughout the year. The third is more of an aggressive, scolding chatter call that's directed at humans or other intruders when they get too close. It sounds a bit like a harsh rattle. If you hear that last sound, you know an angry Leothrix is nearby. Leothrix are common in lowland forests dominated by non-native trees, and in high elevation forests where the trees and shrubs are almost all native. Because they're such active fruit eaters, Leothrix are major dispersers of a variety of seeds, including those from native plants that no longer have other birds to disperse their fruits. Unfortunately, though, Leothrix are also one of the major dispersers of invasive plant seeds, such as Clydemia, Myconia, and strawberry guava, into the remaining native forests of Hawaii. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering nature tours on Hawaii Island with adventures including swimming in private waterfalls, Mauna Kea stargazing, and exploring active volcanoes. More at hawaii-forest.com.
You know, we marked Father's Day this past Sunday, and some might have celebrated with a special meal. Chuck and Kale Furuya did, in a way. They were working the dinner service at Mara, a new Mediterranean restaurant across from the Ala Moana Shopping Center. Chuck was Hawaii's first master sommelier, and Kale is Mara's in-house sommelier. They collaborated on a Father's Day four-course dinner and wine pairing. The father-son duo came into our studios recently and spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about what the Father's Day dinner meant to them.
Traditionally, Father's Day isn't the biggest restaurant holiday, right, Dad?
Right.
So our team at Mara wants to make it a holiday. I've never really worked the floor with him that much, and working the floor with your dad on Father's Day is a pretty special experience, you know?
Well, I mean, and vice versa. For me, you know, he's my son. And so to see him come out of this cocoon and transform into this butterfly, kind of this other being, and specifically professionally, but also personally, you know, that's quite a special occasion for me. And it's a perfect Father's Day gift.
So it's four courses, four wines. Our chef team at Mara is really, really easy to work with. And they really wanted to do this crudo dish as their first course. So it was a kona kanpachi crudo. And the preparation for it calls for off-dry German Riesling. And even though Mara is Mediterranean and German Riesling isn't necessarily, it's not a Mediterranean style wine at all, he collaborates with one of his favorite winemakers out of Germany to make a off-dry German Riesling called CF Eurasian Riesling. And that was the first wine for the first course, like in homage to him for Father's Day, to just showcase part of his life's work. So that was pretty cool.
The thing, what he wrote about it was, when he said it was an homage to his father, I was like, whoa, that's pretty awesome. And also the other thing that it signaled for me is that Mara is distinctly and wholeheartedly Mediterranean. To then all of a sudden switch and all of a sudden offer a German Riesling, I think says something more about integrity and doing something that means something, that makes sense, because this is what the pairing is, not what I want it to be. Mm-hmm. This is what it is. I thought that was pretty special. Not only that, it was the right thing to do, in my opinion. That's what made that pairing special, was that it's like yin and yang. Those two things belong together.
And then what was working the floor that day like?
I went in at like 11 or 12, and all my bosses were like, wow, you're here so early. I was like, bro, if I don't get these glasses polished before he shows up, like, it's not a good look.
It's over for you.
It's just not going to be a good look, you know? So I was literally in the hallway for like 3 hours polishing glasses by myself. And I didn't get them all done before he showed up, but I got most of it done. So to give you the backstory on it, one of my first jobs was when he had his restaurants and they would do these kaiseki dinners. How many courses was it?
12, usually.
12 course dinners. And he would bring me in to polish glasses. And I was maybe like 10 years old.
Wow.
And there was like hundreds of
racks glasses.
And I was like maybe polishing like 3 racks a night. Like, I just was not super. I mean, what 10-year-old kid wants to sit in the kitchen and
polish glassware,
you know? So every time he sees me, or like he'll call me and be like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm polishing glasses right now. And he's like, good. And then when we're working service, he kept coming around to me and be like, what do I need to do? I was like, just stay out on the floor and work. We'll worry about getting the wines to the table. So just watching him work the floor like that, and I'll bring out the wine and I'll make it happen.
Did you feel like you could easily just talk about all those wines and, you know,
schmooze? He was sitting down with tables.
I was like the bear at the state park. The bear just goes to the picnic table and sits there with them. And then, like, trying to shoo the bear away. That was me. I was Yogi Bear. And that's what that night also was about. Cully had created these stories. And so I just wanted to walk around and make sure that those stories were told from as many different perspectives and as succinctly as possible, rather than going on and on. All of these wineries were family-owned and operated. Not that that is a big thing, but it is a big thing to me. It's just something personal, something from a family's heritage, a family's culture. So I think that's huge. Second of all, indigenous. So he chose wines that were specifically from the area, indigenous, but also there are heirloom heritage vines, not all the scientifically propagated vines, and they're farmed sustainably so that they become part of a living vineyard as opposed to just something that's commercially farmed, industrially farmed. The very fact that he was there early cleaning glassware, and the very fact that they were all at the right temperature, the very fact that he set up me so I could just walk around and act like a diva, the wine diva, he did all these things. I think that's also sets a tone operationally. I was telling my wife when I got home, I was like, oh my God, this kid, man. Oh my God, look who he's become. I think that's important today, more so than ever.
He's very much about teaching about fundamentals. And for a sommelier, one of the fundamentals is working the floor. The other two fundamentals, I mean, among many, are clean glassware and serving wine at the right temperature. Like, if we can't provide that, then what are we really doing in our job?
It must be so rewarding to hear your son pair it back to you, all the things that you're trying to instill.
Yeah, I know. Where did it come from? I was like, wow, you know, the very fact that he's, every time I talk to him, he's polishing glasses for the night service. I think that's so unreal.
I think it came from you, probably.
And like my staff will be like, what are you doing? I was like, bro, you don't understand. If there's dirty glasses in here, I mean, it's just, for one, it kills me to look at a dirty glass on a shelf. But like, also just knowing, I mean, we're going to either have to polish it during service, which will jam us up, or serve it dirty, which is not going to happen.
When did each of you know that you wanted to be a sommelier?
So I worked as a server to put myself through college. And I always seemed to get promoted to restaurant management. So eventually I managed restaurants like Bagwell's 24/24 at the Hyatt, La Mer restaurant, the Halekulani. I was a wine cellar master at the old Kahale Hilton for all these years. So I wore tuxedo for 6.5 years. You know, it's that level of restaurant. And then the top honor is Master Sommelier. So you had to go to England and someone had to speak on your behalf in order for you to take the exam. So what happened is, I believe it was 1986, but I could be wrong. I'm not good at dates. But they had the Master Sommelier exam outside of England for the first time ever. Mm. And it was at the Monterey Wine Festival in California. It was sponsored by the National Restaurant Association. So it was a big to-do for the country. It was big. And that was the only year that was by invitation only. And I believe it was 16 Americans were invited. I happened to be one of the 16. So, you know, and my best friend and I went there and we took the exam with very little preparation time. So I just kind of fell into it. But understand, all those years of working in the restaurants, that's what grouted about service. Because when you're wearing a tuxedo and you're performing at that level and you're serving all the celebrities and the dignitaries of the world, I mean, where are they eating at in Paris? Where are they eating at in New York or San Francisco or whatever? They're eating at these top-notch restaurants. So that's the standard that we need to shoot for. And
to represent Hawaii.
Right? Yes, in order to have credibility, in order to have that we are doing something here in Hawaii of a certain standard, then details is what matters. Yeah. So glassware and right temperature and all these details are very important.
For me, I tried to study for my exam a lot of different times. And it wasn't until my last job at Halekulani that it really gave me structure to study. And I was just a bartender. I was super into mixology. Like, I love cocktails. Don't get me wrong. And I think that it's a great culture. But with wine, you're studying history and geography. And you're, like, traveling through time with older vintages and geology and all, and art and culture and tradition through your sense of smell, taste, and sight. It's kind of like martial arts where, like, even when you get to your black belt, like, there's, like, 10 degrees of black belt. You never stop learning, you know? Yeah. So I think that that's the intrigue for sure.
So if I can add to that, even for myself, now that I'm 70 years old, it's the same thing what he's saying. You can never catch up. You can never learn enough. So Kevin Toyama, who's the wine cellar master at the Halekulani, he's one of the best ever here in Hawaii. I mean, the guy is incredible in terms of the wine that he can make and everything. So when Kali started working there with Kevin, I had nothing to do with anything, whether he took the exams, all the tastings he was doing, that's Cully and Kevin and Randall and the rest of the team over there, you know, and I would never push my son in any direction.
That was part of an interview between HPR's Maddie Bender and Chuck and Cully Furuya. We'll continue their discussion right after a short break.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Dean Slider, author of Fear Less. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about how to live beyond fear, anxiety, anger, and addiction.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the Honolulu Board of Water Supply, committed to the conservation and protection of water resources for Oahu. Learn more about how to reduce water waste at boardofwatersupply.com.
Let's return to our interview with Chuck and Kale Furuya. They spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender about the challenges of following in your father's footsteps and lessons learned from the podcast Chuck Furuya Uncorked.
On that topic of learning and continuing to learn, I feel like maybe that's a good place to bring in the podcast.
Aloha, my name is Kale Furuya.
Hi.
Okay, take two. My name is Kale Furuya. This is my dad, Chuck. And we are here today shooting our first episode of Chuck Furuya Uncorked.
Right.
This is a podcast specifically designed to demystify the world of wine.
When we started doing that podcast, that was Kale's vision. And he was always talking to me. So I started learning things from his generation's perspective, as opposed to just how I've done things for 45 years. So it was a breath of fresh air for me to kind of like recalibrate what I do, how I do it, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, we connected through that, and that was like the first
stage
of, yeah, of me really. I was on the show a couple times, but I was really more so about producing it. And we had a guest host. Her name's Ariana Tsuchiya. She's the beverage director for like High Steakhouse and Kiora and La Vie. And hearing them two talk about wine, when I started studying wine and now like helping to make a wine list and stuff, I'll go back and like watch old episodes. And that was like the first glimpse at like, this is pretty cool.
So from my perspective, please understand, when I was talking about the Master Sommelier exam, in the old days, you were apprenticed with a Master Sommelier. And depending on your aptitude, that's what determined how long you would apprentice. And when he, back then was only he, when he felt you were ready, then he spoke on your behalf and you were allowed to take the examination. So that step, that stage of development oftentimes gets lost in today's world. It's all about business. It's all about moving up, making money, et cetera. Not patience and learning the craft like a Grom, as Ariane used to say, like a Grom surfer, a Grom sommelier.
She calls herself the Grom Som.
That's
so
awesome.
That's the point. And so I think that this opportunity of an Uncorked created that between he and Ariana, who are the same age, and then we, both them and myself, learn from that collaboration. So by having two separate generations coming with open arms and learning together, that's when magic can happen. Yeah. That's what that podcast created for me.
When you think about someone following in their father's footsteps, there's a chance of remaining in his shadow. What do you think about in how to follow in your father's footsteps in some ways while making a name for yourself?
For sure. And this is something that I've been asked really my whole life. You know, like he's a very prominent person and I'm proud of that. And that was one of the reasons like I was kind of, I mean, not one of the reasons, but I just kind of gravitated towards bartending. I knew that I liked service industry. And once I started getting into wine, I don't really fixate on that too much because really it's like I just kind of am leaning into it now. Like this is my dad and I'm trying to learn as much as I can from him while making it my own. You know, like I think just him working the floor at me and doing these dinners, instead of fixating on that too much, it's like leaning into it and be like, I mean, this is my dad. What am I supposed to do really? And just trying to be the best sommelier that I can be. Like, I don't know if I'll ever take the Master Sommelier exam, for example, but to me, while I'm doing this role right now, like I'm just trying to focus on doing it the best that I can. And that goes back to the glassware thing. That goes back to showing up early and making sure that I'm showing the staff that I'm here to polish too. Yeah, I'm not just asking you guys to do something that I would never do. So just trying to be the best leader and the best sommelier that I can be.
The thing that's I find so rewarding is the fact that it's like his sister, our daughter, right? Whitney. So she danced for Miss Aloha Hula a few years back. And she, I believe, was one of the favorites that year, I would say. And she came to me one time, we were talking, and I think she was worried about whether she's going to win or not. So my whole thing was, well, if you're going there to win, then you're probably going there for the wrong reason. And from my perspective, you have the ability to show the world your aloha, your way. And what more can you ask than that? Enjoy the journey. Spend the time enjoying your journey rather than dwelling on whether you're going to win or not. Same thing with the Master Sommelier exam. He needs to decide. And I don't know if everybody should go through the Master Sommelier program to keep learning. And what I think working the floor is at least equally as important. And so that's the whole point, is you try the best that you can. and you do it really not half-assed. You go all the way. And so then after that, you enjoy the journey. And so to me, it's always been a challenge, whether it's Whitney, Kali, whoever, that you live in a shadow of something. And then on the other side, my ex-wife's family side, his grandfather was Buzz from Buzz's Steakhouse. There's a legendary Hall of Fame restaurateur. So he, on both sides of the hill mountain, he's got two famous upper ancestors or whatever you want to call it. And to live up to that, how can you? And it's there. You know, you have to learn to deal with it. And he's been able to find his own ground based upon his old time. And he's trying to work at it now more than ever with the focus and making sure the completeness. Now, the rest of my story to him, enjoy the journey.
Could you each say one thing that you respect about the other that gives you pride to call him your father, to call him your son?
He's like the ultimate example of integrity. It's never about money. It's never about anything else rather than doing what's right to the best that he's able to do it. And I think that that's something that he tries to pass on to everybody that he works with. He'll give people his time and just really trying to focus on what's right.
So that guy, Jean-Louis Schaff, he showed respect and homage to all the 14, 16 generations before him. And he does it to the best as he can, but he still does it from him. That's what I look at Kali. Kali, especially with this dinner and understanding what it took to do this, to watch him understand the food and why he did all the pairings. I didn't. I just showed up for him to do things, to watch him mature in the way he thinks and what he does and the methodology and understands and embraces the severity or the homage of it all. That is to watch your child. It's like watching Whitney dance hula and she goes somewhere else. To witness that as a parent, oh my God.
That was Chuck and Kali Furuya talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Another thing we learned about Chuck, he loves a good dad joke. He had this to say during our sound check.
Kali Furuya, sommelier at Mara. It's a restaurant in Honolulu, and I also had coffee for breakfast.
So you had coffee, but you also had milk inside there, cream, right?
Oh, true.
Milk, yeah.
Oh, it's not from the other guys.
These dad jokes
did I
are
tell you
be
I was thinking about
day.
Being a changing careers? I was thinking about becoming a doctor, but I realized I don't have the patience. Yo,
this is going to go in the audio. I hope you know this. This will be on air.
Whenever I work the floor at Mara, and there's people that come in that know him, they're like, "Why don't you tell dad jokes?" And I always say it skips a generation.
Father and son are hopeful that they will get the chance to collaborate more, especially since Chuck Bruya is retired, though he says he has been doing some consulting and is busier than ever. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to talk to our state's correction chief, Tommy Johnson, about the needs in our jailhouses and prisons. Got a story you'd like to share? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217 or email talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The conversation is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google, or online. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.